We love seeing the development of all these series from the new show we're doing with John Watts, Skeleton Crew. But when you look at Andor and you look at Obi-Wan, you look at Mando, you look at Boba, they all do have a different feeling, a different tone. And I think that's remarkable and really speaks to the serialized nature of Star Wars and how it could be a very flexible galaxy. I mean, it is a galaxy, so there's so many stories to tell that it's exciting. But that, I don't know yet. I think that I'm waiting to see a little more as I put it together what that tone becomes, because it's evolving right now. It's evolving.
Yub Nub alert, everybody. Welcome to the Dagobah Dispatch. We are back with Ewoks on the Brain as we follow up last week's deep dive into the 1980s TV movie Caravan of Courage, an Ewok adventure, with a deep dive into the sequel, Ewoks, The Battle for Endor. Why would we do such a thing? Because not unlike my good friend Cypress Hill, we are indeed insane in the membrane. But we're going to do it. You can't stop us. You can only hope to contain us. And if you don't want to hear about a 1985 Ewoks TV movie, that's fine, because we also have two guests by the name of Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni, who are going to talk a little Mandalorian Season 3. Oh yeah, we got that on tap as well. I'm Dalton Ross. Don't hold that against me. Joined as always by a princess and a scoundrel. I won't say which is which. Devin Kogan and Lauren Morgan are here. How you doing, ladies?
Hello, hello. I think Lauren and I both each have a little bit of princess and a little bit of scoundrel. I think I
think so.
Yeah, I think we probably split the difference.
I think we're all princesses and scoundrels, I guess, in one sense. Of course, if you missed it, Lauren and Maureen doing a deep dive on that a few episodes back on the podcast. And we just at EW this week released the exclusive concept art, or I'm not even sure if it's concept art or art inspired by the book.
Inspired by it.
The Princess and the Scoundrel, where you get to see Han and Leia's big wedding, and that's super exciting. So that was fun. So lots of content there on the book side. But that's not what we're doing today. A little bit later, we're going to play you Devin's conversation with Dave Filoni and Jon Favreau, talking some Mando Season 3. But we are doing an Ewoks deep dive again. I guess I would recommend, if you haven't listened to last week's episode, I almost would put this on pause. Like, this is basically part two of our Ewoks deep dive, because we're tackling both the movies, these 1980s TV movies for ABC. And last week's episode, we talked all about Caravan of Courage. I don't know why I just said courage so weird. An Ewok adventure. everything's a little off in this movie. Like, even the pronunciation, when you say it's a little off, it's all a little weird. You should probably go listen to that first and then come back and listen to this, where we discuss Ewoks, the Battle for Endor. Before we jump into that, anything you guys want to add to Caravan of Courage? Any thoughts percolating over the past week about that film, or anything you want to say about your feelings or emotions right before you pressed play on Ewoks, the Battle for Endor?
I will say that, you know, if you liked Caravan of Courage and then you went to go watch Battle for Endor, sucks for you, because all those characters are dead now.
let's start you off. We'll give you a little taste. Let's play a trailer. This is a trailer for the second in the Ewok TV movie franchise, The Battle for Endor, which aired November 24th, 1985. Here's a little taste.
On a far distant world of enchanting beauty, a family of lost travelers find shelter and friendship among the Ewoks, peaceful guardians of the forest. But the peace is shattered. An evil storm sweeps the planet Endor, threatening the Ewoks' very existence.
Run fast, run!
And a courageous Earth child is left orphaned, hunted by the cruel armies of an insatiable warlord.
All I want is the power.
Don't be foolish. Do what he says.
It's a breathtaking adventure that soars to extremes of heroism and treachery.
There's no escape for you, my little one.
But there is hope. A shipwrecked adventurer and his speedy sidekick join forces with the Ewoks. Their mission? Penetrate a fortress of death and rescue their friend, It's a desperate scheme that unleashes the rage of a demented tyrant. From the creator of Star Wars comes a dazzling adventure, a timeless fable of courage and conflict, of bravery, innocence, and unspeakable evil, featuring Wilfred Brimley and the visual mastery of George Lucas. Take a journey to the far reaches of your imagination. Ewoks, The Battle for Endor. Coming to your family from MGM UA Home Video.
All right, so that gives you the basic gist of the film. And just to lay out the plot a little bit for you here, it's 6 months later, after the events of Caravan of Courage. I guess I say like porridge for some reason. And good news, ladies, the family shuttle is finally fixed. They're pretty much ready to finally get off that godforsaken rock.
Woohoo!
But there's an evil marauder warlord named Tarak, who is obsessed with quote unquote the power, as you heard in that trailer. Although he doesn't seem to quite know what the power is and what it does. And he has a witch-like sorceress named Sheral, who can use magic to like shapeshift into either a raven or a fetching blonde. So that's basically the gist of the film. And I'll say this, I've said this many times before, and I'll say this many times again. I feel like the reaction or response that you have to a movie or TV show is so often defined by the expectations you had going in. And Caravan of Courage was so freaking bad. It was so nonsensical. And as Devin so eloquently put it, not like fun bad, but just bad bad, just super boring bad, that I was really not looking forward to watching this at all. And I was really just kind of bummed about it, to be honest about it. But ladies, maybe it's just those low expectations, but this is the Citizen Kane of 1980s Ewok TV movies. This is like, and I'll just start saying this, then we'll start to get into it. But I mean, the best part about it is the fact that the worst part about the first movie, Caravan of Courage, was this kid Mace, this teenager Mace, who was just an insufferable son of a bitch, this guy, just a total jabroni, complaining to the Ewoks all the time, never thanking them, literally firing a gun at them. He's killed in like the first 5 minutes. I mean, they basically kill off the entire family, and we'll get into that, but they kill Mace. That is the key thing of this movie. It's like basically if they were shooting a pilot of a TV show, they watched the pilot and said, this guy sucks, we got to recast. That's essentially what they did. They just got rid of him completely. And I was so happy from that point forward. Lauren, your thoughts when Mace bit the dust?
Well, okay, so I have seen The Battle for Endor multiple times, including the its actual premiere in 1986, I think. I'm 85. So that wasn't too much of a surprise for me, because I do remember most of this movie being just Sindel and Wicket and Wilfred Brimley, of course. So that wasn't too much of a surprise for me. But, you know, I thought it was interesting that they recast the father to the guy from The Breakfast Club, Paul Gleason, and they killed him immediately. But yeah, I have warm memories of this from when I was a child. So, and this is the one I watched more than I watched Caravan of Courage. So, and when I was watching it, I was kind of like, yeah, this is pretty much what I remember it being. And this basically looked, it definitely looked like they put more money and more effort into it after Caravan of Courage, because Caravan of Courage looked really low rent. And this looked like someone was at least paying attention to like the cinematography and the production design and things of that sort. So this looked like this was definitely, I think, a step up from Caravan of Courage, in my opinion.
Devin, your overview, your general thoughts before we go in a little deeper.
Yeah, I mean, I think my biggest shock was, oh my God, they killed the whole family. And like that, it's surprisingly
in like the first 5 minutes, Devin.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. like right out of the gate. And I love that like the trailer that we just watched is very much like a family stranded on Endor. And like, how will they survive? And it's like, no, they're not part of this movie. They are dead within 5 minutes and they are all gone.
And it spoils it for you. You're basically, the dad gets it in the trailer.
It's true. God bless the 80s when they were just like, this is here. We're going to show you the entire movie in the trailer, and you can decide whether mm-hmm. or not you want to go see it or watch it on ABC.
I'm pretty sure this was Thanksgiving weekend as well as was the first one.
You know, nothing says getting together with your family like watching an entire family die and a small girl be orphaned. But no, I think I'm totally in agreement with you guys. This is a huge step up from the first one. I still have a very low tolerance for precocious children and like this kind of story. So I was like, this isn't really for me. But it's definitely... It has more of a plot. It looks better. You know, it's kind of nonsensical. There are no ferrets or llamas in this one.
They got rid of all out a little bit. Animals. Yeah.
There's a horse, but it's a magic horse. And then the witch can turn into like a raven. So I guess there's like birds on Endor. But no ferrets and no llamas. So that was an improvement for me. Although I love the ferrets and llamas. They were my favorite part of Caravan of Courage.
So... The only thing I didn't like about that little a-hole mace getting blown up in the first 5 minutes is that it was off screen. I wish we could have seen it on screen. Like I just wanted to like soak up every single second of it, but didn't happen.
Like bloodthirsty.
Yeah, he really hated mace. I just thought he was a mild annoyance.
No, he's the worst.
It's sort of like if like George Lucas had made like episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, and like the first 5 minutes had been like, you know how you guys hate Jar Jar Binks?
Yes.
We're going to kill him off in the first 5 minutes.
Yes. And then like, you know what? We're just going to kill every Gungan. Like Boss Nass, General Tarples, like, or get all these.
All gone.
Just kill them all.
All gone.
So what's interesting is that they basically, as we mentioned, they recast the dad to kill him off. And he's played now by Paul Gleason, who was AKA Vice Principal Richard Vernon. He's the don't mess with the bull, young man, you'll get the horns guy with the toilet paper stuck to his shoe. So they recast him and kill him off. What was great is the mom, they didn't bring Finola Flanagan back, or she didn't want to come back probably. So they just kind of have her laying dead with her face obscured. Like she's kind of like, you can't see the face. It's just this dead body.
You kind of see her getting shot in the back and she like kind of, but you never see her face. It's just sort of someone wearing a similar wig.
I was trying to wonder about like if this was, because this is right before Back to the Future 2 with the whole Crispin Glover lawsuit. If you remember that in Back to the Future 2, Crispin Glover was not in it. He didn't want to do it. So they hired a different actor that looked a lot like him and had him like hanging upside down. So you kind of couldn't tell and weird, like way in the background. And I don't know if like having a body there and not showing the face, but making you think it's the same person would have counted under, because there's a whole new laws written about what you could or could not do. When I say laws, I mean, you know, whatever, SAG-AFTRA laws or whatever.
Right.
I think it was more just like the soap opera recasting of it's, you know, Friday it was played by one actor and Monday we're going to have like, this is the new actor and that's how it goes. And you just move on from there. So. Yeah,
so she was not back, but they killed her off as well. They kill all humans until Wilford Brimley shows up. By the way, the same year Cocoon came out, 1985.
Oh, yeah.
God bless.
This is a big year for him.
Big year. It's funny because... Mm-hmm. He keeps getting age shamed. He's called old man by like multiple people in the film, even though BT Dubs, he's 50. He was 50 years old when he made this. I mean, he's Wilford Brimley. He looks 70. He always looks 70, but he's 50.
The thing is, like a year later, he was playing a grandfather on a TV show called Our House, which I remember watching, where he was like the old grandfather. And now I'm like, yeah, he was like 52 at the time when he was playing that. So he just, you know, he aged into the grandfather roles pretty early on, I'd say.
Well, there's a great Twitter. There's a joke that, you know, when Cocoon hit theaters in 1985, it's the Wilford Brimley Cocoon line. And so you...
you cross the Brimley line.
You cross the Brimley line once you turn like 50 years and 9 months or whatever. And then you're officially old. And yeah, he spends the whole time, he's just a very crotchety grandpa who's lived alone by himself in this sort of makeshift house. And another piece of casting in this I love is, I don't know if any of you guys are Twin Peaks fans, but Carl Struycken is the, he plays the giant in the original Twin Peaks. And here he is Tarak, the leader of the Marauders, underneath all of that crazy prosthetics and crazy makeup. But that was one of those things where like I would have never guessed it was him, except for the fact that he's like 7 feet tall. But I was like, oh yeah, I love that guy. He's so great on Twin Peaks.
He wants the power, Devin. Yeah. He wants the power.
I wrote in my notes, I was like, this is just like off-brand He-Man, where he's, I think at literally one point he goes, I have the power.
He does.
Yeah. It seemed like this was like a combination of many multiple things that were popular in 1985 that they were just kind of playing off of. So I thought that was, you know, that was giving me like, yeah, this is what I remember most children's programming in 1985 being like.
So one thing that was interesting is how they handled the Ewoks in general in this movie, because they made a lot of changes to the Ewoks in the first movie. One of them was the fact that the Ewoks in Caravan of Courage is that they start speaking English, right? Like they start like speaking English all of a sudden, and they double down on that in the Battle for Endor, right?
Yeah.
Like at the very first,
full
conversations.
But he sounds like Gus Gus from Cinderella, like the little mouse. That's like when I was listening to him, and I'm just like, he sounds exactly like Gus Gus. Like, what's going
on here?
The
one thing I didn't understand, it literally starts off in him and Sindel, like the space disco baby, are like just having a full conversation in English. He's like, we're going to eat soon? Like, hey, you know, like it's literally just like two people walking along in the forest speaking English to each other. But what was even weirder to me is there's a scene later where the Ewoks are being chased by like evil marauders. And so Wicket is trying to get them to like, oh, come this way. And he's going, hurry, hurry, hurry to other Ewoks. Like they're speaking, like he's not just communicating with Sindel. He's communicating with the other Ewoks in their non-native tongue in like a stressful situation where you just want to go to the most familiar, easy word. And he speaks English.
Yeah, it also just raises so many questions about the continuity of, does this take place before or after Return of the Jedi?
I think it's supposed to take place between Empire and Return of the Jedi, which you would think there would be a bunch of Empire people. Like, I read this in like the Wikipedia page, so I don't know if this is still canon. But it was supposed to take place between both
of them.
Well,
then how is Wicket not fluent in basic by the time he meets Leia?
Yeah, or just why aren't there Imperial troopers all over Endor? Because they've got this shield generator that they have been built.
Right, Wilford Brimley's been there for like 30 years and he hasn't seen anybody.
Hold on. So. Stop everything. Stop the podcast. If you're saying this takes place before Return of the Jedi, not only why is Wicket not speaking basic to everyone, but why aren't they eating Sindel? Don't they eat humans? Why is Sindel not like on a roasted pig on a spit, like over a fire?
She was too cute.
This makes no sense.
She didn't look as tasty as Han and Luke did, I guess. You know,
they're waiting to raise her up until she's like, once you're an adult, we'll eat you. But you're so small.
Something must have happened to give them an appetite for human flesh. Did they actually eat Salak, like Wilford Brimley's friend, who like had the power and died? Is that what happened? That's weird. That's super weird. Okay, so that's weird. They double down on the speech. They're talking even more. But then they kind of pull back the other way when it comes to Ewok magic, right? Like there's definitely magic in this film. There's a sorceress we know. There's another creature named Teek we'll get into in a minute. But as far as I can remember, ladies, the Ewoks, who are using all kinds of magic in the last film, have now suddenly lost the power of magic because they're in several battles. There's a battle at the beginning of the film. There's a battle at the end of the film. There's other times they're escaping. And we never see any magic trinkets, no walking sticks, no magic spells. Like, nothing's happening.
Are you saying that they lost the power?
They lost the power.
I do really see the influence of like He-Man and She-Ra in this one as well, because they're like, what do the kids like today? They like magic. They like swords. They like people chasing around for power. Let's put that in there. Violating all previous canon, which I don't think they thought about at this point.
Yeah, it's so funny to me that now, you know, we nitpick over, you know, which episodes of The Mandalorian like connect to which episodes of Clone Wars and like everything that is canon that isn't canon. And in this one, they're just like, yeah, the Ewoks are magic in this one. I guess they're not magic in this one. We got a crazy, weird, sexy witch who can turn into a raven. Sure, that sounds cool. Like, Wilford Brimley has just like normal human glasses on. They're not like space glasses. They're just regular glasses. And it's just like, yeah, sure, whatever. That sounds good.
Are there any other people who wear glasses in Star Wars?
I feel like there's some sunglasses later on, but they're like weird looking in space glasses. And like, you know, there's, I don't know. There's like, but not just like normal Wilford Brimley glasses.
Not like not the I know there's people who wear goggles and things like that.
Racing.
But yeah, I am thinking like, who else has ever worn glasses in Star Wars? No,
just
one.
Wilford
They've
Brimley.
Solved myopia. Yeah.
He just brought them to set, his actual glasses, and the costume designers were like, yeah, sure.
I think it's just people wouldn't recognize him if he wasn't wearing his glasses, because he's been wearing glasses for so many years and various things. And he's got to sell his diabetes medication.
Do you guys want to get into Teak?
Let's talk about Teak.
You want to talk Teak? We're talking Teak here on Dagobah Dispatch. Teak is another denizen of the forest moon of Endor that they introduce. Who? It's so weird because he looks like an Ewok. He looks like a demented Ewok. Lauren, he looks like an Ewok we saw at The Fan Strikes Back, right? Like an Ewok that's like a little bit off. It's like, why not make him like much smaller or bigger, but he's the exact same size. He's a furry animal with just like a demented smile on his face. And it almost looks like someone in like the prop department was smoking the wacky tobacco and then made Ewok. They woke up the next morning and realized, oh, that's not going to work. And then they just made him some new creature named Teak, who has magical powers of like running really fast. He's basically like the Flash without all the Ezra Miller drama. I mean, like, I don't know why he's in the movie. What did, Lauren, what'd you make of Teak?
I just always assumed that he was like something that they made for another ILM property and that got rejected and then like throw him in the Ewok movie. It's like, we have this full animatronic thing, you know, it got cut out of Willow or whatever. We'll put it in here.
I think
here.
You're probably so right.
That's what I thought it was.
I love the special effects of him running really fast, which just looks like you pressed fast forward on your VHS. it's just like, literally, that's what he looks like. There's sort of like a weird rivalry between like Teak and Wicket, because like Wicket's like, there's only room for one like adorable fuzzy sidekick creature in this film, and I have already like laid claim to that. So I don't know what to do with this guy. But that's the whole thing that's so fascinating to me about these Ewok films, is that I wonder if I would like them more, or if I think they would work better if they weren't connected to Star Wars. Like, if you just thought of them as like a standalone like film series, like in the vein of Labyrinth or Dark Crystal, or like sort of the same sort of 80s mm-hmm. fantasy sci-fi stories that were coming out at this time. I mean, like, it has a lot of those same tropes and things, and it just, other than the Ewoks, it doesn't feel very Star Wars to me, which is kind of fascinating. Just it's just so interesting to me that of all the things that, you know, people loved about the original Star Wars trilogy, they were like, you know what, what the people were really clamoring for is just the Ewoks and nothing else. Like, we don't want to have like anything else that feels remote, like no lightsabers, no other creatures, just the Ewoks.
Yeah, that's you. That's Lauren Morgan. Lauren Morgan was their target audience.
Yeah, I was. And it's interesting because whereas in Caravan of Courage, my 7-year-old daughter was kind of wandering back and forth and that, she was into this one. She Ooh. Was like, she was sitting there and she was going, go Wicket, go Wicket. Like, she was in there. And it was interesting because she's the exact same age that I was when this first debuted. So I was like, oh, I get to see how this was working on me when I was 7, because it was totally working for her. Like, she had no criticism. She was totally in the story. She was worried about Sindel. So I think it just speaks to a kid on a kid level. And if you're older than like 7 years old, it does not, you're like, what? But like, it works for kids.
Yeah, as adults, and if you just throw nostalgia out the window, there'd be no reason mm-hmm. to watch this movie, nor would you find it good. But for what it is, I mean, there's no question it's a much better movie than the first one. And I've been thinking about it. It was directed by Ken and Jim Wheat, by the way, who would go on to write a bunch of horror movies like Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Fly 2. They wrote Pitch Black, that Vin Diesel movie in space. and this is my theory, is basically that Caravan of Courage, they were up against the clock. That was the first movie. They didn't have time. They just, you know, you could tell from the special effects. The special effects are so much better in this mm-hmm. film than the first one. There's so many more battles. You know, Caravan of Courage yeah. really didn't have any battles at all. There's a lot of them in this one. And yes, they're regurgitations of what we saw in Return of the Jedi. It's, you know, furry creatures taking down bad guys with trip ropes and rocks and spears. It's the same thing we've seen, but at least you're seeing some action. And even like, you know, you could tell they're cutting corners. It's a TV movie. They're shooting day for night, but it's at least a lot better done. It's not like laughably obvious. like it was in Caravan.
Yeah, this is like properly shot. Someone has lit this and shot it properly, and it doesn't look like someone's just wandering around on a dry hill. Like someone has taken time to compose a shot here. I mean, it still looks a little 80s and low rent, but it looks like they put a lot more money towards this and a lot more focus on actually making this look at least like Star Wars, but on a much cheaper budget. But I thought it was like the whole thing, it looks like, oh, well, let's actually do this properly. As properly as it could have been.
Yeah, it also, you know, one of the things we talked about when you were talking about Caravan of Courage is that they just sort of found some random, like, Northern California locations. They were like, here's a hill, here's a grassy field. Whereas this actually, you know, you see the redwoods, you see the forest.
Yeah, it feels, looks a lot more Endor.
Yeah, it feels like the Endor you've known, you know, from Return of the Jedi. And it feels, in that way, it does feel more Star Wars than the predecessor ever did.
Totally agreed. I noticed that as well, Devin. And this movie actually has actual sets. Like there's the you know, Wilford Brimley's downed Star Cruiser. There's the big mountain and cave sets. At one point, Wicket and Sindel are on the run, and there's a big stop motion kind of dinosaur looking beast. And they built a big set for it. And they built a big mountain set when they're on this. I'm like, oh, okay. That's stuff that they clearly did not have time and money for on the first film, but they had an extra year to get this one ready. And there's a lot more stop motion. You know, also, maybe the first director just, you know, had no idea what he was doing. But this is definitely a more polished production. I mean, it's still a TV movie in the 80s. And you know, the other thing I noticed that was, I don't think we really talked about this at all, that was so weird about the first one. All right, so Lauren Morgan, you're a giant, you know, a big Star Wars fan, and you're a little kid, and you go to see the Return of the Jedi. Who's the memorable Ewok from that movie?
Wicket.
Wicket. Wicket's the only Ewok that most normal people could name and recognize. And Wicket is like a total side player in the first movie, right? Like he's not the main character at all. He kind of shows up a little bit. But he's the main character in this. I mean, him and Sindel, you know, like it's like their little mission, just the two of them, which is makes so much more sense that you would base a movie around Wicket, which is not what they did the first time.
Yeah, the first time it just seemed like, okay, here's Wicket and here's all the background characters. And I assume that Caravan of Courage, there was probably a little bit of overlap with the production of Return of the Jedi, or like, I'm not sure about, they must have been sort of producing this at a similar time or pace. I'm not exactly sure what the production dates were, but this one, you know, it's been like 2 years, so they know exactly for kids what has hit, you know, and so I think they basically are like, oh, Wicket is popular, so Wicket is going to be the centerpiece of the second Ewok movie. So I think they kind of understood it a little bit more about what they were writing to. And also, I think between the two movies that Sindel learned to read she didn't know how to read in the first movie, and she learned how to read in the second movie. So she was able to actually, I think, memorize her lines more. Where in the first movie, it was like they would just kind of feed it to her and she'd say it. So there's all sorts of stuff that they were working with here.
I also wanted to point out something that I found really interesting that I actually didn't know until I watched this and read a little bit about it is, did you notice that the Marauders, did you notice what they're riding? They're riding blurgs, which we know as what Queel rides in Mandalorian. Oh, yeah. So this is one of the few examples of something being introduced in the Ewok movies, which are now considered not canon, and then later becoming canon and later like joining the wider Star Wars universe. It's really interesting. Like these creatures, these blurgs, they popped up in an episode of Clone Wars years ago, but they made their like live action canon debut in Mandalorian where Queel is riding around on them. And so I thought that was like a weird little like, oh, wow, like here's something actually from the Ewok movies that actually made its way into the major Star Wars timeline.
Yeah, which shows you that the production artists are just as much of Star Wars nerds as everybody else because they know all this stuff.
The Marauders didn't really seem to have trouble riding those blurgs, by the way. We've been told that blurgs are notoriously difficult to ride. They did not seem having much difficulty. My favorite scene was where there's a scene where Wilford Brimley, Wicket, and Teek are breaking into the castle, I guess to save the Ewoks, maybe to get the power back. That's unclear. But there's like a big party going on with all the Marauders. And so Teek, who remembers very fast, he steals a huge blanket. And then basically Teek, Wicket, and Wilford Brimley get on each other's shoulders and then walk undetected through a party of giant Marauders. It's total Vincent Adult Man from BoJack Horseman.
Yes!
It's so great.
But then it's again, you know, Obi-Wan used that to get Leia out of the Inquisitorius. So never discount a blanket trick.
It is very Vincent Adultman. You know, they're here to do some business with the Marauders.
All right, so let's sum it up here. Lauren Morgan, your thoughts on Ewoks, the battle for Endor, either on its own or compared to Caravan of Courage?
I understand why I always thought of this kind of, I haven't watched it in years, but I always thought of this fondly. And I did, you know, I understand why I made my dad rent this out of our video store more than once. So it works for a 7-year-old. So that's what I'll say.
Yeah. I think if I was around in 1985, I think I would have like totally fixated on this, and it would have been, it's a huge improvement over Caravan of Courage. It's not a must watch, but if you're a Star Wars fan, like there's a lot of really fun stuff in that. And you know, who doesn't love a great, weird Wilford Brimley performance?
It's, you know, so when it comes to like kids, like I think the difference between the two movies is I would not subject, well, my kids are old enough, but when they were young, I would not have subjected them to Caravan of Courage. I don't think it's, not only is it a bad film, but it's like not even entertaining. It'd be painful as an adult to have to watch it. But I would have showed them Battle for Endor. Like, I totally would have watched them that with them. I think they would have enjoyed it. And as Devin said, Caravan of Courage was just bad. This is not great, but it's like, it's kind of fun and funny. And
it's fun bad.
It's fun okay. It's fun okay.
Yeah. I had more fun watching this one than I did Caravan of Courage. Although I did have a lot of fun watching Caravan of Courage, just taking notes, being like, is that a llama? Yeah,
there's definitely, wait, why it all circles English? Back to the llamas. Devin,
sorry, I'm still stuck on that.
Devin is going to totally George Lucas this film. She's going to go make a special edition. She's going to put llamas in. Like, it's going to be like going through like Salix skeletal remains in the dungeon. There's going to be like ferrets going through the bones.
I want to see the cut of Return of the Jedi where we meet the Ewoks and we're like, you know, Leia and Han are like walking through, you know, the Ewoks treetop villages. And I want to see ferrets. I want the canon. I want to see ferrets there. It, you know,
I want to see a ferret around, like Leia's just wearing a ferret around her.
And exactly. Like when 3PO is like sitting on his throne, there needs to be a llama next to him. Like we just need a whole caravan of animals.
Oh,
it was funny though. This weekend, I'll just mention this really quickly. I was talking to my cousin, who I'm pretty sure I was at her house when this aired, because I usually spent Thanksgiving at her house that weekend. And we were talking about the Ewok movies, and she was talking about how she had a soft spot for the Battle for Endor. And I was just like, yeah, so did I. So I was kind of like, and she's like almost she's about 8 months older than I am. So it is really like that age range of like, you know, there are probably now a bunch of mid 40-year-olds who have a very fond memory of this movie.
I can't express how important it is to the quality of this movie that Mace is killed like 3 minutes into the film. I mean, that really saved the entire franchise as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Look, Devin actually wanted to do an exclusive one-on-one interview with Teek, but we did not have the budget to send her to Endor, unfortunately. So instead, she had to settle with chatting with Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni about season 3 of The Mandalorian instead. We're going to play her chat with Jon and Dave right after this quick break.
Oh, so.
No one needs more about gel coat.
When the fourth round would...
Don't you call in the...
Don't touch that dial. That's right, we're still calling it a dial here, because it's Emmy season on The Awardist. With the dazzling Oscar season behind us, we are now turning our attention to smaller screens to track which shows are headed to the podium and which shows stopped us in our tracks. Join me, Jared Hall, Entertainment Weekly's executive editor, as well as EW's TV-obsessed staffers, every Thursday starting April 4th, as we share our opinionated hot takes and insight into the Emmys race. The Awardist will get behind the scenes with the creators and stars themselves during in-depth, can't-miss interviews. Follow the long road to the Emmys with The Awardist podcast, Thursday starting April 4th, on your favorite podcast platform, and be sure to check out more Emmys coverage at EW.com/awardist.
I
I know the last time you guys were at Star Wars Celebration, Mandalorian hadn't even premiered yet, and now you're here with this whole, you know, stable of different shows. What's it been like to sort of, you know, grow and have all these shows, you know, and work on them and see them grow over the last couple of years?
Well, a lot has changed since the last time we were at Star Wars Celebration. It was my first one. Dave had been to a lot. It was in Chicago, and it was 3 years ago, 4 years ago.
Yeah, wow.
It was before The Mandalorian ever aired. So I was getting to know the Star Wars fans. They knew me from my work at Marvel. I think they knew me as an actor, but it was my introduction. Now coming back here to Star Wars Celebration and to see the appreciation that they've had for the shows that we've made, because now we've done four seasons of television, three seasons of television since then. And of course, now Dave is filming Ahsoka, which is on Disney Plus as well, a live action show following up on the animated characters that he created along with George Lucas for the Star Wars animation.
Yeah, Dave, what's that been like for you to, you know, Ahsoka is this character you followed for so many years. What's it mm-hmm. like for you to have her now headlining her own live action series?
It's fantastic. I mean, it's everything I could hope for. I never kind of dreamed of it as I was learning over the years, but it's just to have a character that's come up, you know, over the years with a lot of fans as they've grown up, and now she's at the point where we can do this, is wonderful. And to be the same person guiding it across the different mediums, I think lends a consistency to the character that's very uncommon. A lot of times when you're an animator, you watch your creation kind of spin off and it's taken by other people, and you know, you never know, and you want to take care of these characters because you know them so well. And it's a really unique situation we're in, but it's awesome. There's no other way to put it. The simple answer is, yeah, it's just awesome.
Yeah, and one of the things I love about these shows is that they're all Star Wars, but they all have their own tone. You know, mm-hmm. Boba Fett has that sort of gangster tone. Sure. You know, Mandalorian is very Western. How do you describe the tone of Ahsoka?
Ha ha ha. Well, that's a great question. I don't know. It definitely is familiar to my other work. When I watch it, I'm like, oh, I was just talking about that. I wonder what that tone is. Cause John and I have been talking a lot about that and how we love seeing the development of all these series and how, you know, from the new show we're doing with, John Watts, Skeleton Crew. And, but when you look at Andor and you look at Obi-Wan, you look at Mando, you look at Boba, they all do have a different feeling, a different tone. And I think that's remarkable and really speaks to the serialized nature of Star Wars and how it could be a very flexible galaxy. I mean, it is a galaxy. So there's so many stories to tell that it's exciting. But I don't know yet. I think that I'm waiting to see a little more as I put it together, what that tone becomes, because it's evolving right now. It's evolving.
That makes sense. Yeah. And along the lines of, you know, making sure all these stories sort of connect. I mean, how much can we expect, you know, Mando season 3 and Ahsoka and Skeleton Crew to intersect?
Well, all the shows that we've worked on, whether it's Mandalorian, Ahsoka, Book of Boba Fett, now Skeleton Crew, they all exist within the same time frame. They all exist after Return of the Jedi. So between, I guess you'd say, between episode 6 and episode 7, there's 30 years there that's somewhat unexplored, on certainly on the screen. To some extent, it's been explored through fiction and through extended universe stuff. So there's a lot of room for us to tell stories. And there are a lot of characters that are in play because we know who's around at that time. And so in The Mandalorian, we begin to introduce those characters. We begin to remind people who knew them already. Or if you aren't familiar with the other work and you just are coming in through this show, we're introducing them for the first time. And this affords us the opportunity to have stories that interconnect and characters that go from one story to the other. And that creates a very rich fabric for us to explore.
Yeah, and from what we saw in the presentation today, you know, Mandalore is going to be a huge part of Mandalorian season 3. What was it about that idea of, you know, exploring sort of that part of Din's story that really excited you guys?
Well, we established in the Book of Boba Fett that there was an opportunity for the Mandalorian to be redeemed because he had transgressed against the creed by removing his helmet, and among his group of Mandalorians, that is something that's not permitted. Now, we know that there are other groups of Mandalorians where they have different sets of rules. In the Clone Wars, we saw with Dave and also with character that I voiced that the Mandalorians are very different there. And so these different groups are coming together, and we're going to figure out how how they all, the nexus point for all of those communities, of course, is their home world from which they're exiled, which is Mandalore.
Makes sense. And one of the other exciting pieces of news today was Natasha Liu Bordizzo joining as Sabine. Dave, what was it that excited you most about bringing that character into live action? And what was it about Natasha that made her the right person?
Boy, I love the characters that have been a part of, telling their story over the years. And Sabine really stood out. She was a different character at the time that we did her. I wanted her to be a lot more colorful than people had seen maybe Star Wars characters and, you know, dyeing her hair and changing it constantly. But I was really convinced that, you know, I was looking at the way kids are now and how they need a character of their own as much as George looked at my generation when I was little and found things that I could relate to through Luke's journey. So I had set it up at the end of Star Wars Rebels in a lot of ways that there was a further story to do with Ahsoka and Sabine. And so just finding the right way to tell that story, the best way to tell that story, something that was creatively challenging for myself. And then, you know, in live action, finding the person to perform that character. Natasha just, it's funny, John and I, we look at these things separately, which is always interesting when we do the casting, and then we come together and we usually come together with the names and we say, well, this person and this person. And, you know, I would say almost without fail, we're always on the same person. It's really fascinating. Yeah. That's our easiest barometer. That's how we do it.
We've been lucky enough to work with a casting director whose name is Sarah Finn.
Yeah, Sarah.
Who I met early on through a lot of through the Marvel projects as well. And so when you have a whole group of casting directors that are working together and understand the tone, the type of actor that we like and the characters, they bring us really, really good choices and sometimes people that we never even think of. Mm-hmm. So much like everything else on the show, it's a partnership. But at the end of the day, it has to come down to, especially in the case of Sabine, of Dave, to feel that this feels authentic to the vision that he had. And also we're coming, as we're talking to you, we're just coming off stage now from having done a panel where Natasha walked out for the first time in front of, the fans. And that really is the most reinforcing moment to know that you picked right, because I think with Star Wars, if you aren't delighted by being a part of something bigger and something that's come before you, but something you could contribute to and shape moving forward, like that's really what's in it for myself and for Dave, is you get to be part of something. And when you get to, you don't always get to hear it directly back, this direct feedback from an audience. Mm-hmm. And I could really see how she felt about being accepted by them and excited by it. So I think that's the one thing that really connects all the people that were on stage who are of different generations from different backgrounds and connected to different Star Wars, that we're all really just feel like this is, we're the luckiest kids in camp to be able to get to do this.
Yeah, one of the things I love is I've loved seeing Pedro really fall in love with this role. And he's one of those people I feel like is just so excited to be here. What's it been like for you? You know, you're now in your third season with him. What's it been like to sort of see him grow and really become such an iconic character?
That blew my mind today when he came out. I mean, again, we haven't been at a thing like this in several years now. And you see that, like, oh, the love of this character has grown, you know, on its own outside. We haven't been at a Comic-Con or at a celebration, you know, and it was amazing. I think really probably rewarding for him to feel the acknowledgement and the special moment, I think, for all of us was him bringing Brendan Lateef out as well and acknowledging this trio that performs this wonderful character, and that it's, you know, again, Star Wars is something that ultimately should make people feel happy. It should make you feel good. It should be uplifting. And that's what I felt in that hall when people are appreciating everyone. And I know it's something that it's just so important to the DNA of this thing. When you think of when you left the original Star Wars, A New Hope, the theater, people were cheering at the end. People felt great at a time when, you know, you could argue things weren't that great outside. So I think it's so important to give people this positive feeling that happens through these characters, this acknowledgement of these actors, where people can come together and say basically, thank you. I mean, that's all I hear all weekend if I run into people is thank you for this, thank you for that. And I think, you know,
That, I've not heard that before, and I've worked on a lot of things. And I don't know if it's because it's Star Wars. I don't know if it's because it's been such a isolating period that we're coming out of, we're beginning to come out of now. But we were, this was very trying times. And you know, launching this new streaming service with this title that nobody had any connection to either one. And people, I think, found a way to find community by watching things together. There'd be people that would stay up and watch it from when it first was put on the service. So some people are up at midnight, 3 a.m, depending on where you lived. And then on social media, they would all talk to each other. They would create memes. They would have message boards. And so I think it was a way for people to come together, even though they felt very alone. And now that everybody's starting to come out and meeting each other in the sunlight again and and seeing that they all share common things, and I really feel that there's a community here. And we went through Disneyland yesterday together. Yeah. And it was a Star Wars night, and it was just very moving to feel how much energy and excitement and appreciation there was.
Absolutely. So for my last question, one of the things you talked about casting, one of the things I love about these shows is all the fun and weird cameos that you guys have, crazy people. Who's your white whale for like the cameo or the actor that you would like?
We've been pretty lucky with who we've had.
I mean,
we have everyone from Mark Hamill to Werner Herzog.
So
Amy Sedaris is great.
But she's just Star Wars fabric now. Like she had no idea. Now she's in it, which I love.
That's right.
She's awesome. But, yeah, I don't know.
We've had great cameos. Is there anybody that...
There's nothing that
George. George Lucas.
I don't know.
That would be the best cameo.
What would you have him play? Where
Baron Papanoida, of
course. He's already established.
Well, he would be much older.
Well,
he would have to be the son of Baron Papanoida or something like that. I don't know.
We have cloners.
Or a whole new thing. I don't know. I wouldn't even speculate on that. It's hard for me to imagine what that day would be like.
Well, he's been on the set when Dave's been directing. So I love watching Dave and George together. George, I have tremendous respect for. I've been very fortunate to have great conversations where I've learned a lot. But when I see Dave and George Lucas together, that's like a whole lot. Because how long did you work together? 12 years?
Yeah, close to that. Yeah, like at least 10. And
yeah,
I mean, it was a masterclass. Every day was a masterclass. And so I'm trying to apply that every day and pass on what I've learned. I mean, it is the Jedi experience I've had. And so honestly, that's probably my biggest responsibility now is to try to explain to people what George explained to me about why this all works, why it's different and unique from any other fantasy series or fiction out there. It's George lent it a unique point of view, and it's something that we have to take care of and, you know, work on to improve again and again and again. So yeah, it's fun.
All right, great. Well, thank you guys so much for joining me.
Our thanks to Jon Favreau, Dave Filoni, and Ewoks Everywhere for joining us this week. And thank you for listening to us talk about what can only be described as Wilford Brimley's finest achievement. We appreciate it, and we'd appreciate it if you could please tell your friends about the podcast. Also, if you could follow the podcast and rate the podcast and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, that would be super awesome. Also, hit us up on social media. You can follow Entertainment Weekly on all socials at EW on Twitter and at Entertainment Weekly everywhere else. You can also tag and follow us at Dalton Ross, at Devin Kogan, and at Morg Lore. Thanks so much, everyone. We'll do it again next week, minus all the Ewoks.
This episode of Dagobah Dispatch is hosted by Dalton Ross, Devin Kogan, and Lauren Morgan. Produced by Chanel Johnson and Sammy Junio. Edited by Sammy Junio. Full episode transcripts are available at EW.com. Thanks for listening.